Biblical Misconceptions by Terry L. Caldwell. Introduction. The Bible, like any other book or subject of interest, has been misunderstood and misinterpreted by many individuals through the centuries. The result is that some of these problems have become part of Christian belief and influenced popular culture. Let's take a look at some of the most common biblical misconceptions and see what the scriptures have to say. Lucifer. The name Lucifer is associated with Satan among Bible believers, and it's a common concept in popular culture as well. But is the devil's name actually Lucifer? This misconception is based on similarities that appear in the writing of the prophet Isaiah, statements Christ made to his disciples, and a passage from the book of Revelation. Let's take a look at each of these and then compare what we find. Isaiah writes, "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations," in Isaiah 14:12. Now let's take a look at a statement Christ made after 70 disciples returned from the limited commission. "And he said unto them, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven," in Luke 10:18. The idea of falling from heaven that appears in both references seems to refer to the same thing. Isolated in this manner, scholars in the past have equated these statements to be an indication of the origin of Satan. In the book of Revelation, John describes a scene that sets the stage for this interpretation. "And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels, and prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him," in Revelation 12:7 through 9. Similarities in these statements are believed to describe the origin of Satan as a fallen angel. According to Isaiah, Lucifer has fallen from heaven. Christ saw Satan fall as lightning from heaven. And John states that Satan was cast out of heaven. The final conclusion is that Satan was an angel who rebelled against God, fought against angelic forces in the heavenly realm, was defeated, and thrown down to earth. At first glance, that explanation seems reasonable until we examine the context of each of these passages. Isaiah's prophecy in chapter 14 begins with a statement of mercy on Jacob and Israel, representing God's children. The prophets wrote about the coming judgment against the Lord's unfaithful people and how it would be accomplished. One instrument of judgment will be the kingdom of Babylon, which takes place under the rule of Nebuchadnezzar. Although the Babylonians would be allowed to implement God's punishment against his people, they would later be judged for their own evil. Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar are the subject of a judgment from God confirmed early in the chapter, as Isaiah writes, "Thou shalt take up this proverb against the king of Babylon," in Isaiah 14:4. The following verses detail God's actions against the Babylonians for their evil, just as he allows them to be the instrument of punishment against his own people. Nebuchadnezzar's arrogance is apparent in the book of Daniel, and the Babylonians are characterized as a bitter and hasty nation in Habakkuk 1:6. Judgment against Nebuchadnezzar in particular is detailed in the book of Daniel, and prophecies such as Isaiah's include the entire nation. In Isaiah's writing, Lucifer is used in reference to Nebuchadnezzar, who would be cast down in his arrogance by God's judgment. Lucifer in this passage refers to the planet Venus, a bright body visible in early morning and well known in ancient societies. Stars and other celestial bodies are used in prophetic language to refer to governments, kings, rulers, and their power. From the context, we can conclude that Nebuchadnezzar, not Satan, is the subject of the passage in Isaiah. Christ told his disciples he beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven, which is a reference to the effect of the message being preached and the coming fulfillment of God's plan to save mankind. The power of Satan lies in deceiving and tempting humans to sin and be separated from God throughout eternity. The writer of Hebrews speaks of the effect that Christ's sacrifice had on humanity and the power of Satan. "For as much then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also himself likewise took part of the same, that through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, that is the devil, in Hebrews 2:14. When Christ came into the world, his presence marked the fulfillment of God's promise to save humanity made to Adam and Eve in Genesis 3:15. The gospel neutralizes Satan's power, taking away the fear of death and eternal judgment. In that sense, the loss of the devil's power is characterized in this passage, describing him as falling from heaven. Satan's defeat was imminent and sure. Although there is a similarity in language between the prophecy of Isaiah and Christ's statement, they're discussing two different subjects. John's statement in Revelation concerning Satan being cast out of heaven following a war between the devil's forces and God's, led by Michael the archangel, seems to parallel the statements of Isaiah and Christ, but it doesn't. The book of Revelation is written in signs and symbols. The opening of the book specifies the events foretold would shortly come to pass and were specifically addressed to the seven churches of Asia. The similarity in language and imagery points to a common point of origin, not subject. The images in Revelation aren't literal representations of events. They figuratively describe things that will take place at a point in the future. Taking this into consideration, we can conclude that the similarity in language points to God as the source, but due to the immediate context of each passage, that's where the similarity ends. Another thing to keep in mind is that the statements of Isaiah were dealing with a time period that ended with the conquest of Judah in 586 BC and the end of the Babylonian exile in 536 BC. Christ referred to Satan's power being compromised by the teaching of the gospel in the early first century, so that isn't consistent with Isaiah's statements. John's writing in Revelation is a symbolic prophecy, referring to things that would shortly come to pass but hadn't happened yet. That's inconsistent with Christ's statement because he referred to Satan as being in a fallen state as he spoke to the disciples. The conclusion that makes sense and harmonizes with the passages I've noted is that Lucifer isn't a reference to Satan, and Satan's fall was through judgments against him and the preaching of the gospel that neutralized his power over humans to deceive. In light of the scriptural evidence, Lucifer, the morning star, represents the downfall of Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians, which was fulfilled centuries earlier. This doesn't mean that Satan is powerless now. Peter states, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about, seeking whom he may devour," in 1 Peter 5:8. Satan continues to work to deceive the world according to the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians 4:4, but his influence is defeated by the presence and power of the gospel. Individually, we can overcome this by understanding the will of God revealed in the Scriptures. When we come to a knowledge of the truth and obey it, we are translated from the kingdom of darkness into the church, the body of Christ, in Colossians 1:13. The written word has the power to dispel misconceptions like this and lead us home to heaven. The Ten Commandments. Many think that to live a godly life, one should believe in God and practice such things as the Golden Rule and the Ten Commandments. The commandments given to Moses on Mount Sinai in Exodus 20, while being an important part of the law, don't represent its entirety. One could consider the Ten Commandments as a preamble or introduction to the law. In addition to the Ten Commandments were numerous statutes, regulations, and ordinances for the people to follow. The book of Leviticus is an instruction manual for the priests and Levites in making decisions, rendering judgment, and governing almost every aspect of life for the children of Israel. The books of law, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, detail these laws and how they were to be applied. The problem for Christians in the first century, as it is for many today, is a failure to grasp the purpose of the law. Paul states, "Wherefore the law was our schoolmaster to bring us unto Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after that faith is come, we are no longer under a schoolmaster," in Galatians 3:24-25. Once the gospel was revealed, the law, or schoolmaster, was no longer needed. Paul reminded the Galatian Christians that if they desired to be under the law, they were indebted to keep the entire law, in Galatians 5:3. Questions about Gentile Christians and the law were a problem in the first century and caused controversy. It wasn't necessary for Gentile Christians to keep the law. In Acts 15, James sums up the things the Gentiles needed to abstain from during a conversation about this subject. Wherefore, my sentence is that we trouble not them which from among the Gentiles are turned to God, but that we write unto them that they abstain from pollutions of idols, and from fornication, and from things strangled, and from blood, in Acts 15:19-20. Paul, in his letter to the Colossians, speaks of the passing of the law. He writes, "And you, being dead in your sins and the uncircumcision of your flesh, hath he quickened together with him, having forgiven you all trespasses, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross," in Colossians 2:13-14. Judaizing teachers of the day sought to bind traditions of the law on Gentile converts, as well as Jews who had become Christians. The problem with this thinking is clarified in the New Testament, which reveals that the law wasn't able to bring about the full redemption of sin. That took place only when Christ died on the cross and was raised from the dead by God. The writer of Hebrews makes it clear that the blood of Christ was applied to the sins of the faithful of all time. Comparing the sacrifices of the law to the sacrifice of Christ, the author states, "How much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? And for this cause he is the mediator of the New Testament, that by means of death, for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first testament, they which are called might receive the promise of eternal inheritance," in Hebrews 9:14-15. Paul states that holding to the law rendered the sacrifice of Christ ineffective, writing, "Christ is become of no effect unto you, whosoever of you are justified by the law," in Galatians 5:4. Christ stated that he had come to fulfill the law in Matthew 5:17, and in that fulfillment, the law was taken out of the way. According to the writer of Hebrews, the law was passing away at that time, as the gospel of Christ was taught. After quoting the prophecy from Jeremiah 31, the writer states, "In that he saith a new covenant, he hath made the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away," in Hebrews 8:13. The person who lives by the Ten Commandments will no doubt lead a good moral life and cultivate a belief in God, but won't be saved simply by following these principles. Elements of the Ten Commandments that apply to us today can be found in the New Testament. Commands to worship God, avoid idols, and not commit adultery are applicable and stated in the New Testament, telling us how a Christian is to live. The Ten Commandments, however, contain things we can't observe as part of the new law. This includes keeping the Sabbath. Christians meet and worship on the first day of the week, not the seventh day, as the Hebrews were commanded. Likewise, the priesthood, decreed in the law of Moses, has been replaced by the great high priest, Jesus Christ. The writer of Hebrews states, "Seeing then that we have a great high priest that is passed into the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession," in Hebrews 4:14. Unlike the Levitical priests, Christ is sinless and eternal, and his law, the New Testament or gospel, serves as our guide today. Since the first century, the relationship of the law of Moses to the gospel or New Testament has been a primary misconception in the minds of many believers. The Antichrist. Years ago, I was introduced to the belief in the rise of the Antichrist and his persecution of Christians. In one publication, there were depictions of believers being hunted down and decapitated in a mobile guillotine for not having the mark of the beast on their hands or foreheads. In more recent years, novels have been written dramatizing the rise of this figure, as well as movies, comic books, and video games. These stories are frightening and entertaining, but they demonstrate another biblical misconception that's been popularized over the years. There's a long list of individuals who have been identified as the Antichrist. In World War II, it was Adolf Hitler. During the Cold War, Nikita Khrushchev, leader of the Soviet Union, was given this title. In the early 70s, as the Paris peace talks to end the Vietnam War were underway, Henry Kissinger's name was transliterated into Hebrew characters, assigned numeric values using a mathematical formula, and totaled. The sum of the values ascribed to the letters were then interpreted as proof that he was the Antichrist described in the book of Revelation. Who is the Antichrist, or Will there be a single individual we can identify as the Antichrist? Let's see what the Scriptures have to say. The term Antichrist appears 5 times in the Scriptures. All of these occurrences appear in the writings of John. Addressing Gnostic influences, John writes, "Little children, it is the last time. And as ye have heard that Antichrist shall come, even now are there many Antichrists, whereby we know that it is the last time," in 1 John 2:18. John states there were many Antichrists and refers to a spirit or attitude, not a person. This attitude is one that opposes the gospel and Christ. John defines this as he states, "And every spirit that confesseth not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God. And this is that spirit of Antichrist, whereof ye have heard that it should come, and even now already is it in the world," in 1 John 4:3. This passage lets us know that the spirit of Antichrist was present in the world at the time of John's writing, manifesting as a spirit of deception, denying the identity of Christ. There are other ways that this spirit of unbelief can manifest in our time. Any doctrine that can't be supported by Scripture partakes of the spirit of Antichrist. Teaching things that are incorrect is a denial of Christ, as it compromises the authority and identity of the Word and Jesus as the author and finisher of our faith. A multitude of doctrines claim to be Christian, and these have created division in the religious world. Paul indicates that this is the working of Satan, who seeks to blind the minds of humans so they can't see the truth of the gospel and be saved, in 2 Corinthians 4:4. Since the beginning, humans have rejected God's authority. Paul speaks of this as he deals with false teaching about the second coming that plagued the Thessalonians. Describing a coming apostasy, Paul explains how this could happen and what God would do. "And with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they received not the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this cause God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believed not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness," in 2 Thessalonians 2, 10-12. Christ also warned of future deceptions as he spoke to his disciples. "For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect," in Matthew 24:24. Deceivers and their lies would be very convincing. The fabric of the deception would be so believable that even those who understand the Scriptures will be challenged at times. Well-articulated arguments, as well as great signs and wonders, will deceive a great many people. We have a defense against deception, and that's the gospel, God's power to save, in Romans 1:16. As we turn our minds to God, submit to His will by accepting what we read, and then obey it, we become enlightened in a godly way, and this attitude will lead to salvation, if we're faithful, in Revelation 2:10. Evil rulers and powers will come and go. That's the history of the world and mankind. The gospel will continue to be misrepresented, mistaught, ignored, and denied. This is the spirit of Antichrist, not some world ruler. That makes the idea of Antichrist much more dangerous and immediate than misconceptions of a turbulent time in the future. The number 666. I've had experiences while paying for something where either the sale amount or change due came up to $6.66. Cashiers have given me a strange look and changed the amount by a penny or so, explaining that they're afraid of the number and wanted to change it. I like to use that moment to explain why the number isn't one to be feared, but I probably won't make a big impact on the superstition. But I try. Around Halloween, the number, associated with evil, gets a lot of usage in various ways. For those who subscribe to the premillennial doctrine, this number stands for the Antichrist and has been interpreted as appearing in different forms, including data systems and government identification, as a sign of the end times. Concern over 666 and the resulting fear is another biblical misconception that's become embedded in mainstream thinking. This idea comes from the book of Revelation, in which John writes, "Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666, in Revelation 13:18. The first thing to note is that this is a singular individual, a man. Secondly, although the image of the beast is associated with a man, and represented by the number 666. He isn't referred to as the Antichrist. As a matter of fact, the term Antichrist isn't found in the book of Revelation at all. So we're talking about a man identified as the beast, not the Antichrist, represented by the number 666. The beast is associated with the influence of Satan in Revelation, so is the number a figure for Satan? A deeper look at numbers used in the Bible supplies a practical answer to this question. Revelation contains prophecies expressed in signs or symbolic language and are difficult to understand. The context of the book limits the time in which the prophecies were to be fulfilled, stating they were to shortly come to pass in Revelation 1:1 or shortly be done in Revelation 22:6. As with other images in the book, we have to treat the number 666 symbolically as well. A key to understanding the number is in the behavior of the beast man. This man would have the ability to deceive through lying wonders in Revelation 13:14. What then is the reason for the number? We can answer that by looking at numbers used by God in the Bible that have a powerful symbolic presence. Three principal numbers are used to signify the identity, power, and work of God. These numbers are 1, 3, and 7. 7 in the Scriptures is understood to denote completion, perfection, and the fullness of God's work and power. The number 3 is used to represent the Godhead, the work of God, and fulfillment of His work. The number 1 is used to represent the singularity of God's presence, truth, revelation, purpose, and power. The three numbers, 666, representing an agent of Satan, having the power to deceive, is significant. We have the number 6, which is one digit away from 7, repeated 3 times. The repetition of this number and the attribute of deception on the part of the beast man implies that he'll be able to convince people that he's the power and truth of God when in reality he's a deceiver working to destroy souls. Christ stated, "For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that, if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect," in Matthew 24:24. The Scriptures contain a number of warnings about deceivers and false teachers who would lead others astray. In Revelation, the combined attributes of appearing to have the power of God, as well as persecuting Christians, indicates the presence of a powerful and convincing lie used to suppress the truth. Paul the Apostle warned of a falling away or apostasy in the church, and its characteristics mirror the presence of such a distortion of truth in 2 Thessalonians 2:1-12. What better way to deceive than to teach things that are close to revealed truth, but not close enough to lead one to salvation? The beast man of Revelation 13 may indeed be symbolic of an individual who will be succeeded by others like him, perpetuating deception and manipulation of God's truth, causing souls to be lost. Paul states this would be possible because those deceived wouldn't receive the love of the truth but would accept and believe a lie in 2 Thessalonians 2:10-12. The number should be understood as a warning about deception, not the presence of a demonic leader who will take control of the world. We can avoid that by cultivating a desire to know the truth that's found in the Scriptures. The world is filled with doctrines that have some basis in the Scriptures, but lack the true power of God to save by teaching partial truths and eliminating essential elements of the doctrine that's present in the Scriptures. We don't need to be afraid of the number 666, but we do need to fear being fooled spiritually and lost eternally.